Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. The conversation you're about to listen to was scheduled to take place live on stage at the 2020 Festival. Instead, our guests have come together from their homes to share their stories and perspectives.
Hello, everyone. I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which these events ordinarily take place, and the land upon which I live and work. This is a place where stories have been told for millennia, and I would like to acknowledge that we are a part of that long continuum, as I acknowledge the violence with which that belonging has been seized. I pay my respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. My name is Roanna Gonsalves. I'm an Indian-Australian writer, author of The Permanent Resident, published in India as Sunita D'Souza Goes to Sydney. I have the great honor of being in conversation with Golriz Gheraman. Golriz Gheraman made history as the first refugee to be sworn in as a member of New Zealand's parliament in 2017. Iranian-born, Golriz arrived in New Zealand with her parents seeking asylum as a nine-year-old. She studied human rights law at Oxford and has practiced as a lawyer in New Zealand and for United Nations tribunals in Africa, The Hague, and Cambodia. Her work has included trials of leaders for genocide and war crimes, restoring communities after war, and human rights atrocities, particularly empowering women engaged in peace and justice initiatives. Golriz is a member of New Zealand's Green Party. Her memoir, entitled Know Your Place, is published by HarperCollins and is out now and available for purchase. And it is the focus of our conversation today. Welcome, Golriz.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
Golriz, I would like to say congratulations. It's a huge achievement to have a book out in this world, and a book such as yours, even more so. As I read your book, Know Your Place, I was struck by many things. I was actually moved to tears by some of the horrific abuse you have had to face in your life as a politician, but also moved to tears by the way you write about loss and hope and transformation in your book. I wanted to begin this conversation with you by asking you about your motivation to write this book at this time. It's a timely account of how one woman navigates public life, while also speaking to the broader issues that we all have to navigate in this world. And you, as a writer of this book, I think you do this in a nuanced, polyphonic way through the stories and voices of so many others woven in with your own story, which makes for very compelling reading. So I would love to hear from you about the genesis of this book itself in terms of wanting to write it.
Yeah, it's a very surreal thing to write something like a memoir and have it go out into the wilderness, and to hear back from readers, you know, as to what they kind of what resonated with each different person and each group, and I think it's interesting to hear you say that you were moved to tears in the chapter about the kind of the online abuse that I get as a woman of color, essentially in public life, because I think it's sort of confronting for us all to know where that might take us as we become more and more visible. So it's young women of color have kind of come up to me and said that as well. I think that whenever someone gets to write a book that kind of brings out a story or a voice that's not often heard, it feels really timely. But it's exactly that which drove me to sort of accept this offer when it came, because I felt like at first, you know, I sort of went, oh, I don't have enough to say, you know, I'm not old enough, I haven't done enough, and then I started to feel a sense of sort of panic of, oh, well, you know, when else do nine-year-old asylum seekers get to grow up and get a book offer to tell that story? You know, when else are my parents' generation of Iranians going to have this story told? Or, you know, refugees in a Western South Pacific nation or anywhere in the West, you know, get to have that story told. And so I took it up, knowing I wasn't necessarily the best person to be writing a book. I'm not a writer, but that at least it would introduce some of those stories, and maybe more of us will start to tell our stories.
Yeah. Yes, I totally agree with this idea that you just mentioned of when a woman of color writes a book or tells their story, it feels timely. And that's because there is this huge void, this aching void that when it is filled, even in a small way, or in multiple ways by multiple people, it feels timely because we've been waiting a long time for it.
We've been waiting so long. And it is that thing of, Iranians trapped in Iran feel completely silenced. And then, you know, whether it's Middle Eastern or, let's face it, Middle Eastern looking people in the US when 9/11 happened and the war on terror happened, and East Asians in New Zealand when COVID hit, it's that we've been dehumanized by the void of our voices, you know, in public life and in storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I was reading your book, I very much got that sense that you were honoring the people that you come from. You had this memory of all these ancestors behind you, your heritage behind you, and you were honoring your parents and back to the culture that you had to leave behind, your homeland. And you write with, and I would like to come back to Iran in particular a little bit later, but before we do that, I want to ask you about something really interesting that you write about, which is the idea of the grateful migrant and the responsibility of critique as a grateful migrant. Like you must be critical because you are grateful. It's not the other way around. And I love that about your work. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I must have picked that up in some ways from my mother, because she's always been this loud voice pushing back, criticizing her own culture. As an Iranian woman, as a Middle Eastern woman, as, you know, a woman from that so-called Muslim world, and she's determined that it is her culture. You know, she gets to shape it too. And so, you know, in New Zealand, we are, well, at least in Auckland, quite a diverse community. And it's all of us that make up that community. So, you know, to say that you're criticizing our culture doesn't make sense, because it does actually belong to all of us, and we get to say what is and isn't working. Because ultimately the endeavor is to make things better for us all. So kind of, you know, that idea that patriotism is a love of this country, and a love of this country means that you wouldn't expect or accept anything but the very best for her. And, you know, whether that's leadership or policy, whether it's calling out, you know, abuse online, because you don't want anyone to kind of have to face that in our community. Yeah, so I think, I think that idea that democracy is about critique is really important. And, you know, we protecting our democracy means that we feel free to kind of voice our critique.
Yes, absolutely. And particularly as migrants who, you know, that we all feel grateful to be accepted here, and particularly someone who has been offered asylum as a refugee, someone who's a refugee, that feeling of being grateful, that feeling of relief, etc. And it's purely because of that that we need to be more protective of the freedoms.
But I think the idea of the grateful refugee, or the, you know, the good refugee, or the grateful migrant, the model migrant, is dangerous to us. It's, you know, and it is, it's that thing where we do face discrimination, and instead of kind of working to change those systems, and there's plenty more than just the migrant community who want to make our communities sort of discrimination free, but instead of doing that, we internalize the hate and we try harder and harder and harder to just fit in And, you know, we do it as women, you know, women in the workplace, you know, you just have to keep your head down and you have to, you know, all of that stuff. Because if you're outspoken, if you claim credit, if you want to change anything, then, you know, we're seen as being pushy, or, you know, the jeering, you know, voice of a woman in a meeting, that kind of stuff. And it applies to migrants and other minorities as well, where the idea that we need to fit in rather than the system needs to be fair to us, you know, that idea is kind of dangerous and oppressive, and we shouldn't stand for it.
No, absolutely. And it's, and as I was reading your book, I felt it's about reimagining what that idea of grateful means. You know, it's about kind of subverting it in some way to include responsibility as well as
absolutely. And, you know, for us, for my family as political refugees, we moved for democracy and, you know, for things like having freedom of religion or freedom from religion in our case. But, you know, that actually to me means that, you know, when the Muslim community here peacefully practicing their culture are under attack, I have to stand up for them too. If anyone is able to be oppressed for being a minority or for, you know, for having a different religion or race or political view, then that's really the same as the Islamic regime in Iran, you know, kind of winning. It's just a different minority that's being oppressed. So I do take that really seriously, because I don't want that for New Zealand as part of my gratefulness.
And now, just thinking a little bit about Iran, I wanted to ask you to talk about Iran, the land of your birth, your homeland. And you write quite beautifully about Iran's progressive culture not being a symbol of Western triumph, you know. And
yeah, and I think, you know, more than anything, we as women of color get trotted out often as being the symbols of Western triumph, and I used to get asked that. I probably will again once I start campaigning, where people kind of go, oh, well, you know, how can we make all migrants assimilate as well, you know, integrate, whatever the word was that they would use, as well as you have. And when pressed, it would emerge that, you know, that why do you think I've integrated so well? Why do you think, you know, I've become so Westernized? And it would be things like, oh, well, you know, you dress this way, and you know you have an education, and you're independent, and those are all things that I picked up from Iranian feminists, you know, and you know, that commitment to higher education, you know, for women as well as for men, and that kind of the sense of independence that came from watching Iranian feminists, men and women, push back against the oppression and the patriarchy back in their homeland. So I think it's interesting, because then, you know, the old photos of Iranians wearing mini skirts and dancing and that kind of stuff, the same for Afghanis, and there's different cultures where our photos get trotted out as being, you know, this kind of, oh, you know, remember how great and Westernized these cultures were, and now look at how backward they are. But we're still there. It's still our culture, and it's not Westernization. It was always our culture. We've got an oppressive government right now, but it's not about the West then rescuing us from the oppression. It's sort of about acknowledging the voices within every culture that speak to feminism, environmentalism, democracy, human rights, because we've all got them. And you know, New Zealand is a place where, for all of the freedom and all of the equality, and, you know, for being the first place in the world to give women the vote, we still have one of the highest rates of domestic and sexual violence, you know, gender-based violence. So to attribute that, you know, to New Zealand as a culture, it, you know, would that be right? It's about our voices all being heard.
absolutely. In Australia, while we do have a political class in power who are quite backward-looking, this is also a place where progressive openness to the world has flowered despite that backward-looking political class, despite all odds. And so you see this brilliant writing by First Nations people here, by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers. You also see this in the excellent work being done by minority writers, including work about Iran. So while Behrouz Bouchani was being incarcerated by the backward-looking Australian political class in power, his translator and publishers are here in Australia, Omid Tofigian, and Picador's published him. And we also have a wonderful writer of Iranian background whose book is currently on the shortlist for the International Booker Prize. That's Shukufeh Azar, The Enlightenment of the Green Gage Tree. She wrote it in Persian and it was translated into English by Wild Dingo Press here in Australia. It's a novel set in the aftermath of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and its fatal consequences for one Tehran family. There's also Rashida Murphy's book, The Historian's Daughter, which is partly set in Iran. These are just three examples. So while the trans-Tasman relationship is being let down, betrayed, damaged, and you know, weaponized by whiteness in many ways, quite tragically, as we've seen recently, there are many old and new solidarities between immigrant communities that uphold the connections between Australia and New Zealand. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's so funny. When I went to the really big event at the Writers' Festival in Christchurch, where Behrouz for the first time, you know, got to speak, and we had John Campbell, who's, you know, very well-respected a journalist and you know, just sort of father of the nation type level. Sorry, John, if that makes you sound older than you are. But and he was hosting it, and he sort of said to Behrouz, you know, this is just such incredible writing. It's poetic, it's rhythmic. And I thought, that's so Iranian. Iranians are just such literary people, and poetry is so valued. So I'm not, you know, it's no surprise that whether it's film festivals or whether it's sort of literature, that's what's coming out of the Iranian diaspora, even from the depths of deprivation on Manus Island. But it is interesting to see that now as the refugee crisis globally sort of rages on, and migration and displacement are just have become decade after decade part of our sort of the fabric of humanity, how much there is solidarity across those migrant communities now. And it's almost like we have a culture that's a migrant culture, no matter where you're actually from, and we relate to each other in that way. But after Christchurch happened in New Zealand, the conversation that emerged that was, I think, the most interesting and welcome in terms of how we're going to face and dismantle white supremacy was the solidarity between Māori, our Indigenous community, and the migrants of colour. So, you know, when New Zealand is different than Australia in that that kind of the levels of sort of broad government-wide racism may not exist, but obviously we had just realised, you know, or at least the mainstream culture had just realised that really, really quite violent and extreme racism exists here, and that's come from somewhere, and that, you know, these pockets of prejudice have driven this. So, you know, while we're having that conversation, the initial knee-jerk reaction, I think, was to kind of go, not in New Zealand, you know, this isn't us. That was really calming for sort of the first hours and day or so, but actually to the affected communities, it was terrifying because it felt like they'd been raising alarm. They'd been trying to fix these problems in the system, and suddenly, even in the face of mass murder, you know, the nation may have turned away. So but it was interesting because it was Māori who stood up and sort of said, actually, we can't fix this without having the hard conversations. And and we've been facing this for a couple of centuries now. So it's time to have the hard conversations. You know, this isn't the first mass murder for white supremacy, because the New Zealand Wars, which we don't teach in schools here, were the first white supremacist mass murders. And they're not that long ago, and our language was ravaged and our resources were taken. And sort of, I think the refugee community, as well as much of the sort of migrant community in terms of migrants of color, realize we've had similar experiences, you know, of imperialism, having our culture and language sort of lost to us because of wars that we didn't ask for and our resources gone. So that conversation has been really interesting, and the solidarity has been really beautiful. So we've, you know, we had the Muslim community turn up in force, you know, when there was a Māori land protest at a place called Ihumātau, which is a sacred piece of land, and the land protectors have won now. But, and it was in solidarity with the migrant community, you know, just 6 months after Christchurch. So, you know, and that's kind of, you know, that can be a global piece of work.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. Thank you for giving us a sense of what happened in after Christchurch there, and connecting it to this, the sacredness of land and solidarity between communities, white, Maori, Muslim communities in that case, coming together to protect a sacred place. And I wanted you to talk about another beautiful thing you write about, which is the personhood of nature. And we were talking earlier before this conversation about rivers being accorded the status of personhood.
Yes.
In India, based on what happened in New Zealand.
That's right. And that's beautiful. So we have the Whanganui River here that was granted personhood. It's kind of in reflection of the sort of Māori worldview that we continue through the land and nature, and you know, we're sort of the guardians and the protectors rather than sort of the owners. and the thought system creates a generational sort of connection where you have to look to the future as you are guarding and protecting the resource for future generations and your ancestors. That includes the land and the river and you know, the forests and it's interesting because we would call it a resource, but it's just an interconnected system of being. And I think most Indigenous communities have that sense that has kind of been lost to the modern value system of, you know, personal ownership and profit and all of that. But people are kind of starting to realize, well, actually, do we really want profit to sit above all of our interests, including whether that's democracy, whether it's human rights, whether it's environmental protection, and as we kind of face a global crisis in the climate crisis, where, you know, an entire generation of young people just rose up to tell us, you know, they are going to hold us to account if we let this continue. It's nice to see that we actually can turn back and go, well, Indigenous people have been saying this for some time. Absolutely. That's what I think the personhood of nature is about. It's about recognizing that if corporations can be people and nature can't, then we've got our values upside down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Which brings me to that idea of fair international trade that you write about in the book as well. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
This is something that I started to get really alarmed about while I was studying international human rights law, where we have to look at how to make these beautiful international instruments effective and enforceable. And one of the big barriers is that there is a sort of a class of big global multinational corporations that profit from a certain kind of system. And that system was a global financial crisis, you know, crisis that fell and took us all down with us a little while ago. And so it feels important not to kind of forget that that system isn't working, and that it trade is actually undermining democracy. So we sign these free trade agreements, and we give away our governments and future governments' rights to sort of regulate for us. We give away, in Australia, I think, learned this lesson. You know, the government may have given away its right to put warnings on cigarette packets for a while there. You know, you had to litigate that for millions. And you wonder what stuff didn't get litigated that just quietly regulation fell away, and the public good fell away because there was a threat of litigation. So why do we protect the interests of a class of people that don't necessarily even have a national identity, and they sort of sit above the rest of us? And their profit margins count for more than, you know, the well-being. And when you look at cigarettes, it's literally death of ordinary people. So I do enjoy the trade portfolio, and we're doing a lot in terms of saying, well, if we're going to write these trade agreements that aren't really all that much about trade, they're much more about protecting, you know, certain, you know, they protect things like privacy rights of corporations above our privacy rights, you know, and we've got like data protection that's the winning and losing elections right now. So, you know, do we want to give that away? So if we're going to write all of these types of interests into a trade agreement, why aren't we writing in workers' rights and human rights and the rights of nature? As well, you know, do they get to pollute because it's more profitable to pollute? Well, you know, let's put our climate commitments in there so they can't. it's been a really interesting portfolio for me, one that I didn't necessarily seek out, but it went with foreign affairs. And then I realized it was valuable to have an international lawyer in there sometimes. Mm.
Yeah, just related to that, I wanted to ask about your life in Parliament, really. But before that, to talk about your just amazing maiden speech in Parliament. We have Senator Mehreen Farooqi here, who's a Green senator. She's a very inspiring person herself.
She is.
Yeah, and her maiden speech was just a watershed moment for a lot of us, you know, listening to her talk about being an immigrant and being a woman of color in Parliament. And it moved me to tears. I know it did move a lot of other people to tears. But I wanted to ask about your maiden speech. It is in the book, and it's a beautifully written speech. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that moment, about the people who were there in Parliament that day, and your how you came to that moment and to that speech, and afterwards what happened.
It's really interesting. I think everybody should sit down and think about what they would write in a 15-minute maiden speech. because it is really this thing where traditionally you talk about where you've come from in terms of your life, and where you, you know, what you're hoping to achieve in there. I was really acutely aware of, by that point, of this idea of being the first ever refugee MP and what that meant. I knew it meant different things to different people. You know, my face and my story. And I hadn't intended for that to be the case when I put my name in. I'd been a long time Green, and I was kind of, I had these ideas about coming in and bringing human rights law to, you know, lawmaking. And that was going to, you know, that was supposed to be my stump speech. But as kind of I made my candidacy public and Donald Trump had just won and Brexit had just happened, you know, and Australia is still caging refugees on prison islands or whatever, I started to get this deluge of messages from actually around the world, and, you know, especially in that sense from Trump's sort of America, where he was talking about the Muslim ban, and from around New Zealand. And there was, you know, there was all this love and excitement, and there was this idea that, you know, in New Zealand we were getting to stand as a counterpoint to that politics of hate and division, which was extraordinary to me. I hadn't realized that, you know, again, it's that void, and people had been feeling it so acutely. It felt so important just that point about representation. And so, you know, my fear was that I was feeding tokenism, but I had realized that my own personal ideas about tokenism were maybe less important than how everybody else was sort of feeling. But then with that also came a deluge of hate, because there was another community, and for them, my face and my story meant a very different thing. A lot of times it meant fear. You know, it's probably coming from that a place of fear, right? Of sort of losing power or whatever that is when you've had it. So, you know, in such a monopoly. And so there was all of this abuse. And the abuse sometimes got so jarring as to include threats of gun violence. So it felt important to me to include that in my maiden speech. I didn't feel like I could stand there and say that I was a representative of a community without including both of those experiences. So I put that in quite early on in the speech. And more than that, I was standing up and talking in Parliament for the very first time among all of these faces that I recognised, you know, from TV, from politics over the years. You know, parliamentarians stay in the House for a long time, you know, and I knew that there were people there who had contributed to that, the culture of sort of discrimination and division and hate. So I had that choice to, you know, to say that or not. And it was, and I knew that because it's such a defining moment, I didn't want to be there and not call those things out. So I said it. You know, I said that we face this stuff out on the street, including some of the threats, because prominent people feed that culture and validate it, just as Trump does. So I alluded to, and you know, everybody kind of knew who I was talking about, but without naming people, the people in that house, including a former prime minister and including a newly made minister, and some of what they had said about our communities. And, you know, people don't heckle maiden speeches, they're done in silence, but someone did start to heckle. Someone from their party had to kind of go, no, don't make this a thing. So it was tense, but I think it's, I think, you know, just as Marine has done, it's important that when we come to these positions that we behave like we have a right to be there and to speak the truths of our communities. We're not just there, you know, to go to Diwali festivals and to, you know, these cultural festivals and whatever, which is what I think sometimes people just expect, you know, and that would be tokenism.
Yes.
Those were the types of thought processes that I had in my mind. And then, of course, it was really important to me not to just talk about that, because I don't want to ghettoize the worth of our people when we do rise to positions of leadership in only our race experience. So I did end up setting out the human rights stuff too.
Yes, which was just fabulous, which makes me think about this line quite early on in the book where you say, actually, it's later on in the book. I'm not giving away any ending. It's not that kind of book. It's a very layered, beautifully layered piece of writing. But you say we are all capable of life beyond victimhood. You know, that idea of, yeah.
Yeah, we get trapped in our victimhood. It's one of the other stereotypes. So there's the grateful migrant, the good refugee, and then there's the perpetual victim. And all of those things, I think, and there's gendered aspects to them as well for us as women in particular. And, you know, so the good refugee stereotype that I was guarding against was, you know, that constantly whenever I was trotted out, it would be, you know, the Oxford graduated, you know, the lawyer, you know, all of my credentials. And so it would be, and sometimes it was for campaigns to increase our refugee quota, totally worthwhile. But is it harmful as well to kind of go, Well, look, some of these refugees, they really do deserve to not be tortured and killed for their race or religion because they get a master's degree from Oxford. It's like, no, you know, that's not really protecting our humanity. But then there is the victim, you know, and this came out in New Zealand just a couple of years ago when, and I was asked to comment, where a school in a small town who was trying to educate the little kids about refugees had a Dress Like a Refugee Day event, and the children were encouraged to dress in rags and come to school. And it was completely well-intentioned. They were completely, you know, but the impact is that refugees are seen as these, you know, really downtrodden people who are not like us, and they dress in rags and, you know, whatever. And of course, some refugees end up in rags because in crossing borders and leaving everything you have, you may end up that way. But actually, at one point, those same kids had birthday parties and cool clothes. Yes. And, you know, so...
That's a really interesting point about refugees being seen as people who dress in rags. When in your book at the start, you talk about walking barefoot in New Zealand being a way of establishing your New Zealandness, your legitimacy as like a proper Kiwi, and that idea of class and how class is interpreted differently by different cultures. The markers of class are interpreted differently.
Totally. And Australia and New Zealand are probably among the most casual places where class is a little bit blurred. It of course exists, but in terms of, you know, we don't call each other by our formal titles, or you know, wear suits to work necessarily. And yeah, that thing of when we first encountered people walking barefoot, and just how revolutionary that was to us. and we were encountering people who thought we had come from a place that didn't have electricity, and didn't, you know, and they were asking those kinds of questions, and you know, like, did you have a fridge? You know, have you ever seen a microwave? And we were just transfixed on these barefooted people asking us, going, why don't you have shoes? You know, and it was, you know, because only the poorest person elsewhere in the world would probably walk around barefoot, right? But it's actually a really beautiful sort of, it's about egalitarianism in a way. And I talk about kind of that thing of bringing a plate, you know, if you're throwing a party and you can't really provide for everyone. So you kind of just, everyone brings a plate, and it's about just getting together and having a nice time. Whereas in Iran, you're kind of part of it as like providing this opulent food. And so I do love those little bits of Kiwi culture.
Just to go back a little bit to change tone quite a bit, actually, to go back to what you were saying about being a parliamentarian and how you have to negotiate at the coalface every day in public life, you know, all of this, these messages and gestures of support and love and solidarity, but also quite horrific abuse, you know, threats of death, etc. Terrible. And there was a very interesting incident that you narrated where you had all of this abuse on Twitter, and accidentally your partner had been tagged. The abuser tagged your partner, and the result was that the abuser called your partner to apologize to him, which was so interesting.
It was funny because he hadn't realized that my initial tweet, which was an article, was or an opinion piece, was written by my partner. So I had tagged him because, you know, it was his article. And but because I'd posted it, I was getting all this, you know, like, you don't know what you're talking about, and that was one of the really that was because there's all these different strands of abuse that I get, and one of them is you just don't know what you're talking about, you're uneducated, I think that's quite misogynistic. So we as women, you know, other women in those positions also get exactly the same thing, where it's like, well, what's your qualification? And often I have the actual right qualification, but that's not what being a representative is about anyway. So that was the really just this persistent, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, and like trying to kind of pull any kind of fault in the argument. But of course, it wasn't my article. It was written by my comedian partner. And so someone, yeah, the one of the kind of big proponents of this abuse thread wrote a message to him directly and apologized to him. And what really struck me was within the apology, he said, "I wouldn't want you to think that I'm just one of those old white men who hates Gowries." And it was like, I wouldn't want you to think that.
Yeah. Exactly.
So
don't care if Goldrist thinks that.
No, that's fine. You, like, you know, if she thinks everyone hates her, that's okay. That's and, you know, and so when Guy, my partner, wrote back to him and said, well, you know, great, you know, thanks. Well, you should apologize to her. And he sort of said, oh, no, you know, and it just all disappeared and dissipated away. It was really interesting to me that he was worthy of an apology and I wasn't.
Yeah. And that actually brings home the point that you make about the need for participatory representation. And you say, you know, we need participatory representation or else we risk being swallowed whole by majority rule democracy. And that is just, that resonates across many different cultures, really. And I'd love to hear a bit more about that.
So I think, you know, we get, because there's this idea that you can go and consult with women and with minorities and or you can kind of have like a particular department for us or a ministry or whatever even. I mean, most of us don't get a ministry, but you can have like a one person in the workplace whose job it is to do diversity stuff. You can, you know what I mean? But actually we need to be integrated. Like our perspectives need to be represented by us in every arena. And what kind of really drives it home to me is my friend Ghazali, who I mention in the book a lot, and who's a filmmaker, and her work in kind of acknowledging that it's not enough to have sort of a character in a movie who is ethnic. You have to have the people behind the camera, the people who are writing that movie, the people who are making decisions about funding movies more broadly. It needs to be that our perspectives are done in that way, because otherwise, you know, the stereotypes keep persisting. And it's the same in sort of any kind of decision making where you go, well, actually, how do you decide what a woman's issue is or what an ethnic issue is? We are affected by all issues. You can't sort of go, a cisgendered, straight, white man is going to decide what issues belong to a disabled, queer woman of colour. You know, she's experiencing justice and housing and roads and healthcare with all of those identities built into it. And she's not going to get a voice unless she's actually, and people like her are actually included in decision making on all issues.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that ties in with what you were saying earlier about, you know, the harmfulness of that idea of the grateful migrant, grateful refugee, or the victim, and the importance of critique, etc. And you talk, you mentioned the work of Cornel West, particular quote of his, which is, "Never forget that justice is what love looks like in public." And that is just such a beautiful quote. And you talk a lot about how that manifests in your own career, really.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's, I find it to be a deeply comforting quote because I think those of us who have experienced, like personally experienced that kind of broader global injustice or trauma or whatever it is. And, you know, I've got my parents in my life who've lost so much to these big global pestilence, whatever you were going to call them, like war and oppression and, you know, theocracies kind of bringing down their lives and their hopes and dreams. I can't restore them. But you can kind of, you can work for justice more broadly in society, and that is what love looks like. And then, you know, when you look at some of the work that I've done in particular in terms of being a defense lawyer, for example, and understanding the justice system itself as trying to protect fairness, even when the absolute worst has happened, you know, the fact that we do afford basic human rights to us all, and that is what love looks like in public. And our justice system is pretty broken, but just kind of working for systemic justice is just such a beautiful thing. And I feel like it at least helps me to reconcile my own absolute luck in this world and having escaped as such a young child without having been as damaged as I could have been, or my life having been as impeded as it could have been. And so it's kind of a way of giving back for those of us who are that lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen this manifestation of love in action in public, with New Zealand raising the quota for refugee intake and welcoming Behrouz Buchani. And you have a very lovely chapter at the end talking about about that moment at the airport.
Yeah, so we actually did, I will just say, we doubled our refugee quota. It came into effect yesterday.
Wow, that's
but
fabulous.
Per capita, we welcome far fewer refugees in Australia. So that's an interesting, you know, that's another one of those misnomers where we get to sit next to this big bad, you know, cousin or whatever and feel a little bit better, because at least we don't have prison islands for asylum seekers. But, you know, we could also do more as well. And doing more would probably reflect more closely who New Zealand, you know, wants to be. But, yeah, welcoming Behrouz Buchani was absolutely one of those moments when New Zealand got to be, you know, that sort of that manifestation of us at our best and how we understand ourselves, and sort of that global sense where, okay, Australia didn't accept the offer to resettle the Manus or Nauru refugees here, and that was devastating. And it was devastating to be here in government while that offer was remade to Australia and rejected again. But then also we kind of, you know, the visa was given to Behrouz to come here and speak. I think what was really beautiful is that the visa and his coming here came about for him as an author. You know, obviously he is a refugee and he gets to have his freedom too now, but he also got welcomed here as an author in a writers festival. That's what got him here. So going to the airport and welcoming him through those exact, you know, doors that my family had walked through at Auckland Airport was just so overwhelming. And to think, you know, he's around my age and he got trapped there, you know, and he did what I might have done, which is to be a student activist, you know, a unionist. And he's Kurdish, and, you know, I'm Kurdish on my mother's side. So he spoke up for the rights of Iranian Kurds as indigenous people. And that is absolutely not okay under the Islamic regime. So, you know, he's a real embodiment of all of the things that the West says it wants for the Middle East. You know, it wants us to be all educated and freedom loving and you know, resisting our big bad governments, but when things got too dangerous for him, it wasn't all that easy to get Western support. And as it turned out, the worst of what happened to him was actually done onto him by a Western power that says it stands more for freedom than the Iranian regime does. And for Behrouz and for the other detainees, it's absolutely the worst that anyone's done onto them has been done by Australia. So, you know, just knowing that that's what's happened to another person of my generation while I got to be free, it was incredibly emotional to kind of meet him and have those conversations.
Yeah. And that somehow speaks in many ways to the title of your book, which is Know Your Place. And you know, it's like what happened to Behrouz is what happens when refugees are seen to not know their place. You know, they have to be put in their place. Yeah.
That's exactly right. It's sort of like, you know, we do have these big bad oppressive governments, and you know they're bad and they're being condemned all over the Western world. But also, don't you dare try and get free. You know, don't you dare try and actually have human rights, because actually we don't consider you quite as human. And I think that's where the link lies between things like the abuse that I get online, the reason my parents had to leave their homeland, and the reason Behrouz had to do the same but was also then detained on an island in what most of us would easily consider conditions of torture. There is a link, and it is white supremacy, it is racism, it is our loss of humanity, and whether that's because we don't get to be on the screen or behind the cameras, or whether it's because we're not in houses of representatives, and those who are willing to gain politically from our dehumanization. These are all linked, and that's what justifies the very wars that we are now escaping, constantly, perpetually escaping.
Absolutely. And just in closing, I wanted to just say that as you were talking, I was thinking the work that you're trying to do, like many are trying to do, is to change the narrative, to look at these competing stories that exist and to change the narrative in some way. And I think your book is a big step in that direction in many ways. And yeah,
it's one step at mm-hmm. least, you know, that's how I see it. I see it as one story among all of the stories that are not being told. But at least if there is one, and then we take a bit more interest and we publish more and we read more and we kind of learn to listen to each other. And I think the majority of people want that. I don't think Pākehā or white New Zealanders, for example, are at all, pleased with the lack of stories. And I think we saw that Absolutely. After Christchurch. Everybody was distraught. You know, people were so committed to change. But we don't, you know, we don't want another act of violence to happen before we kind of start to make that change. So storytelling might be one of the ways we start to weave that love that we saw after Christchurch into an enduring fabric of our society.
And on that note, I would like to say thank you so much for a most insightful conversation, Golriz. Thank you so much for giving us your time. To listeners, Golriz's book, Know Your Place, is available for purchase from your local independent bookshop, or you can also order it online. Please join me, listeners, wherever you are, in thanking Golriz for her time and for being part of the Sydney Writers Festival in 2020.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.